Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
My name is Hannah Forden. I'm the membership coordinator at Heritage Radio Network, but even before I joined the team, I loved listening to HRN during my subway commute. It made the time go quickly and left me feeling inspired for the day ahead. HRN listeners tune in from all over the world, but there are a few traits that we all have in common, no matter where we listen from. A curious palate, the fierceness to make a difference, and a hunger for lifelong learning about the culinary world. As you know, Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported nonprofit. To deliver the most ambitious, entertaining, and of-the-moment stories in 2018, we need your help. We need to raise $150,000 by December 31st to accomplish these goals and to keep your favorite shows on the air. Together, we can make this HRN's most exciting, impactful, and delicious year yet. No matter how much you choose to give, you'll feel awesome next time you tune in, knowing that we wouldn't be here without you. Become a member by donating today. Join us at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and you'll immediately start enjoying benefits such as VIP invitations to HRN events, where you will mix and mingle with your favorite hosts. Plus, we have great member swag. Show off your HRN pride with a t-shirt or keep your hands safe in the kitchen with an HRN potholder. Memberships also make a perfect holiday gift for all the foodies in your life. This year, why not give the gift of food radio? You'll hear your generosity in action for the year to come. Help keep our lights on and our mics hot by pledging your support today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thanks for listening.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. For the last time this season, I'm here with my wife, Caitlin. Hello, Caitlin.
Hi, Andrew.
Kate, I don't know how to even strike the right tone to begin this show.
Yeah, I get it.
It's the last show of the season. It's the holidays, which I love. I had all these things I want to say at the end of the year, and I'm going to ask listeners, anyone who fast-forwards through the intro, please don't fast-forward today. It's the last episode of the season. There's a couple of things I want to say. There's a few people I want to thank. I know a lot of people zoom through the intros. I've done it with other shows myself. Please just hang with us for a minute or two. I'd really appreciate it. We aired an extra episode on Monday with Curtis Stone. We had taped the intro that morning. Anybody who listened to that episode that day and thought it was odd that there was no acknowledgement of the, I don't know if you could even really call it a bombshell anymore because we're just expecting several of these stories every day, but the news about Mario Batali stepping away from his company in the shadow of four women who came forward with sexual harassment claims and complaints. It's because we taped that interview early in the morning, and you went off to work. I drove our kids to school. I came home, and that's when the news broke. We didn't know that news at the time. I haven't been talking about every bit of news on this front that's come out, but this obviously is a big story. There's probably no bigger name in the chef community than Mario. He's certainly up there with everybody. He's somebody we've known. We don't pal around with him. He's not like one of our intimates. But we've known Mario forever. I mean, I met Mario when he was at Poe, which a lot of people probably have never even heard of, when he was the only guy in the kitchen and was sort of a one-man band.
I met him at the Food Network. My early, early days
when
of producing.
When you worked at the Food Network.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the early 90s.
Yeah, Malto Mario.
Yeah. And, you know, it's... I will be honest, most people in the industry were not surprised. This was one that was expected. Even if you didn't know details, you had heard murmurings forever. And it kind of has challenged me because, as I said several episodes ago, I don't know how to do a show with chefs in the name, and at the time it was the John Besh story. I didn't know how to do a show with chefs in the name and not acknowledge what was going on. And by the same token, a story this big, I don't know how to do it. But I did want to talk, Caitlin, and I'm kind of glad you do these intros with me for a different reason today. Usually, as some people know, it's because I have a hard time just being in an empty room talking to the audience. But what I find myself thinking about is I just finished a book, and I've been very disciplined about not torturing listeners with pre-plugging the book, which is coming out next year. And this is the last way that I wanted to even mention it this season. But I did a book about the chefs of the 70s and 80s. There's a young Mario Batali in the pages of that book. Not a major character at that time, but somebody who's quite eloquent, and he's in there quite a bit. Even if I wanted to excise him, which I don't particularly because he was an important person, I couldn't. The book's set. It's you know, on press, as they say, or about to be. It's at a point where no major changes could happen. You know, I don't know how people are going to feel about seeing him in the pages of the book. But moreover, what I'm really struck by is almost 10 episodes ago of this show, I think, I got on this intro and said I would really love to have a conversation with someone on this show, male or female, about the topic of sexual harassment, even though this is not a current event show. And, you know, it's not like we're the Marc Maron show with that kind of listenership at this point, but we have a substantial listenership. It's mostly industry. I literally gave my email on the air, and I didn't hear from anybody. And then it occurred to me, I did a couple hundred interviews for my book. I don't know if half those interviews were with women cooks and chefs, but I could safely say I interviewed dozens of women chefs across many generations. And almost always when I interview a woman chef, especially for that book, I would specifically say, "What, can you please tell me about your challenges as a woman in this industry?" Almost all of them, less so with certain chefs on the West Coast because of the better culture out there, but a majority of women told me about chauvinism they faced in the business. They would tell me about things like you could only be on garde-manger or be a pastry chef as a woman. They would tell me about how men would kind of play games with them by asking them to lift really heavy things or reach too high, you know, things like this. Off the record, they would confess affairs to me. They would confess drug use to me. Almost nobody brought up sexual harassment and or sexual assault. Now that this story is breaking, every woman I know is telling me that they're not surprised. They've heard these stories for years. And I saw a lot of talk on Twitter today about this sort of willful ignorance of people covering the chef trade. And for me, it's been a puzzlement that more women, and many of these people are people that I knew before these interviews, who I would consider friends of mine, who I think more than most men, they would be comfortable confiding in. It's a puzzlement to me that when presented with an opportunity to talk about this, it never came up. And I'm wondering if you, as a woman, can help me understand that, because this is really something that I'm trying to get my head around. You know, where I have maybe failed in this story, or where maybe I haven't said the right thing to make someone comfortable enough to talk to me about this topic.
Well, I mean, look at us, right? I just recently filled you in on the details of when I was sexually harassed by somebody.
Yes.
And I've had two or three instances where that happened. One, it was back in college, and it was actually really traumatizing for me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like talking about it. I mean, I don't like talking about it now. I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I find the whole topic really uncomfortable. And I'm, you know, part of me is really ashamed that I found myself in that situation,
right,
even though I did nothing wrong.
Right.
So I'm assuming when you're talking to women about their experience in the workplace, they want to keep the the conversation, as it should be, focused on their work.
Yeah.
So if you're talking to women about sexual harassment, it's not about their work. It's, you know, it's not about their contribution in their to their job.
Right.
And they don't want to talk about that.
But I mean, neither is chauvinism, right?
That's, yeah, but it's not sexual, and it's not, I mean, that is so...
Personal?
Yeah.
Intimate? It's like a forced intimacy. Is that what you're saying? It's an intimacy that's been forced on you.
Yeah, and there's something about it that is so, it just chips away at everything you've contributed to your own career. And I think that that's so when people, you're talking to people about their business and their careers,
yeah,
they really don't want to talk about it in that context.
At a level beyond all the other things that one would consider sexist, chauvinistic, unfair.
Yeah, all of that is more kind of the tone of the workplace, and I think that women have dealt with it their entire lives. But there's something so kind of personal and impersonal about sexual harassment that it's so wrought for women.
Well, it is. Thank you for talking about it. And I'm going to, you know, renew my invitation. I if somebody hearing this week, our season is officially done when this airs, but... You know, if there's someone in the studio to get the show on the air and there's someone who wanted to come on the show and talk about this, I only do in-person interviews. I have to say that because of sound quality issues and especially a topic like this, I would want to be able to be face-to-face for the full time to have a proper conversation. But I'm going to renew my call, and I'm guess I'm going to become a little more motivated and probably approach some people that I've seen on social media, even some people I don't know particularly well, and see if they want to talk about it. I feel a real need to talk about this. I've said it before, this is not a current event show, but this thing, you know, the most amazing sentence was said to us. We were at dinner a few weeks ago, and the chef at the restaurant, male chef, came to visit with us. And I said, who do you think is going to be next? And he thought about it for a second and said, honestly, it could be anybody. Or honestly, it could be almost anybody. And that, I think people are just starting to grasp that. I saw a lot of that on social media today saying, you know, tip of the iceberg. This is a story that's going to keep being in this industry for months to come. And so anyway, anyone who is out there, I'll just cut to the chase. You can reach out to me on social media. Tokeland Andrew is my personal Twitter and Instagram handle. At Chef Podcast is the show's Instagram and Twitter handle. And I'll say it again. You're welcome to email me, andrew@tokeland.com, TOQUELAND.com, andrew@tokeland.com. And if you are based in or will be in New York, and I can get to the same place that you are with my podcasting equipment, I will meet you anywhere, anytime, male or female. I think it'd be most appropriate to have this conversation with a woman in the industry, but or maybe 30 minutes with a man, 30 minutes with a woman if possible. And I'm very eager to explore this in the most real possible way. Not as a regular thing, but for one episode. I just think, again, having a show called Andrew Talks to Chefs, it's mostly fun and games, but I think it has to be done. I'd like to, you know, do my part to contribute to this dialogue. So that's what I wanted to say about that. Last PS on that topic, on my old show, The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, which is still available on iTunes and on the Heritage website. Episode 10 of that show was actually a show about stories confronting women in the industry. One of the three threads that we had tackled was this exact topic. We had three women guests, a journalist and two chefs, and we had Aaron Fairbanks, who was the former executive director of Heritage, co-host that show with us, and I think it was a pretty good conversation. Nothing like what's happening right now, because this cat wasn't fully out of the bag, but probably worth a listen if you're interested in that. It's easily found online. Okay, now, I'm going to abruptly... I almost want to put a music cue in and come back.
I was
going to
say, you're going to change the tone.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to start ringing like jingle bells. Okay. And, you know, we're not wearing Christmas hats as we do this, but I'm going to shift tone. And in a moment, I'm going to introduce our guest for this week, who is Richard Blaze, who most people probably know. And I'm happy to say he is a joyous guest, and we had a great time. But just quickly, we are at the end of the season, and I do want to thank a few people. Caitlin, thank you for doing these introductions with me.
My pleasure. It's been really fun.
Yeah. Many people told me it's their favorite part of the show.
Oh, my God. I'm so sorry.
Well, I'm sorry for you. You may not be able to get out of this. I know where you live. And so thank you. I usually do this at the end of the show, but I need to thank David Tatasciore, our engineer at Heritage, who it's extra work for David. I think I'm the only person, maybe there's one or two other shows that pre-record always. So splicing this together is more work for David. Thank you, David. I need to also thank Evan Sung, my buddy, who's took the photograph that you see on our iTunes and Stitcher page, the black and white of me coming through the kitchen doors, which really set a tone for the show. Evan, thank you for that. My childhood friend, David Miller, who has a band called After School Special, which provides the theme song you're going to hear right after this intro, and also the break music for the show. Katie and Kat and the gang at Heritage, all these people have just been hugely, hugely important to what has been a triumphant, for me anyway, feeling first season. And of course, all the chefs. And I have to say, I'm often down on the publicist trade because I was a publicist once in my life. I was not a happy camper. But there are a lot of people who do it well and do it proudly. And a lot of those people have been really instrumental in bringing some chefs who I had never even met to the show this season. So thanks to all of you guys. I'd also like to dedicate this season, if that's not too corny. I had a dear friend, an older gentleman, but it was still a shock, named Joel Buckman. Kate, you knew Joel.
I really, really love Joel.
Joel was an attorney, did a lot of work in the spirits realm. I met him because he was the attorney for the Bocuse d'Or USA, which became the mentor organization. He was one of the most passionate food people I've ever known. Joel, one of his very best friends in the world was Daniel Boulud. And we got to be pals when I was in Lyon writing Knives at Dawn, my book about the Bocuse d'Or. And when we got back, I became part of this sort of informal lunch club that Joel and his good friend Bob Grimes, who's the president of City Meals, who's become a good friend of mine as well. Just an awesome, awesome guy. And about a month and a half ago, quite unexpectedly, Joel passed away. I was just at a lunch in his honor. It's a lunch that annually has been sort of a secret annual Christmas lunch. Some of the people involved have been Instagramming pictures as tributes to Joel in the last week, and I did want to dedicate the show to him. And for the last time this season, I'd just like to renew my call for people to please subscribe to the show. Everyone knows by now that we really love if you would rate or review us, but mostly I'd love for you guys to subscribe because we're about to go on our mandatory Heritage Network holiday break, and you won't be seeing new shows in our social media feed, and I just don't want to lose track of you guys. I can entice you by telling you the first guest of the new season, when we do return in January, will be the amazing chef Missy Robbins, who is the chef at Lilia in New York, which is probably my favorite restaurant at the moment, who also wrote an amazing, very personal, very revealing cookbook. And that's going to be a great interview. I haven't done it yet, but I know it's going to be great because I know Missy, and I'm so looking forward to it. And if you just subscribe to the show, which is free, sometime about this time in January, that'll pop up in your feed, and then you'll start getting shows every week. And sometimes, like this week, maybe more than once a week. And it doesn't cost you anything. So I just want you to do that so that you keep hearing these interviews. Okay. Now, having said all that, Richard Blaise is someone you guys probably know from Top Chef. Did you know him from Top Chef, Caitlin?
That's exactly where I knew him from.
Okay. So Richard
And I was actually kind of secretly thrilled that you were interviewing him because I loved him on that show.
Did you?
I did.
Okay. So Richard was in season four. I guess you'd say he got kind of known as like the molecular guy on Top Chef. As he reminded me in the interview, there was a chef testant named Marcel prior to him, who I'd just forgotten about. I thought Richard was the first molecular guy. But he kind of got a lot of attention like that. He came in second on that show, and then he actually won Top Chef All-Stars. So we can say he is a Top Chef past champion. And boy, has he made a career out of that launch pad. He was already a chef in his own right with pretty serious background. He had staged at the French Laundry and worked at Danielle, and he'd been to the Culinary Institute. But he has really, he's one of these people who took that moment and that capital that you get coming out of Top Chef. And he's opened several restaurants. Most best known probably is Juniper and Ivy. These are in the San Diego area. And the Crack Shack, which is a fried chicken concept. He's written two books, Try This at Home and So Good are the two books. He recently started his own podcast. So I guess he technically is competition for me, but I'm not really competition for him. He's way more famous than I am. So, but it was still generous of him. And there was, I think, a lot of comradeship, solidarity in him coming on a fellow podcaster show. And I had never met Richard Blaise before. I've met a number of people just oddly in my life who were past champions of that show. I had never met Richard until this interview. I instantly love the guy. He's charming, funny. He's very, there's a lightness about him. You know, he's light on his feet. He's got incredible energy. He's very quick-witted. He's also, Caitlin, and we've met people like this over the years. One would be, we met Buddy Velastro, the cake boss, years ago, and got to know him a little bit. There's certain people in life who I just feel are born to be famous. They just have...
Oh, he's got that star power?
He's just got that.
Yeah.
I think it was inevitable, probably. If it wasn't Top Chef, it would probably have been something else. He's, I don't even know if star power is the right term, but there's just this magnetism about him.
Mm-hmm.
And this easy confidence. He's got a look, you know, that doesn't seem very affected. It just seems to be who he is. And it was really funny. I don't think intentionally, but in this interview, he almost couldn't help it. He kept almost kind of trying to take over the show and interview me. But he also has a show, so I think that's fine. But it's a far-ranging interview. I'd put this in the biographical interview category of shows that we do, but we do cover a lot of ground, and there are a lot of fun tangents. And that's all I'm going to say about it, except to say thank you again to you for joining me for these intros for most of the season.
Of course.
And with that, everybody, here is my interview with Chef Richard Blaise, recorded about 2 weeks ago at the office of Baltz & Company, one of those PR firms I was just mentioning, in New York City. I hope you enjoy it. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses to make some sense of this.
So I like to do it too. Just leave the mic open and walk into the room and get going. Sorry.
Keep going. Can you count
to 10?
I'm on
mic two. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
So... This is why it's great to have a fellow podcaster on as a guest, because this literally, we started doing the sound check and I just started recording.
Yes. And I don't think anyone's ever said to me like, hey, it's good to have a fellow podcaster sitting next to me. Like, this is really? The first time for me. Yeah.
Do you like that?
Because it's a new it's a new title for me, you know, because it's like, you know, Mother of Dragons has many titles.
Uh-huh.
And podcaster is now one of mine.
Yeah.
And recently people have been saying, I love your podcaster. You know, how is it being a podcaster? So it's a new thing for me. So it's tough to hear. It's like when you first become a chef.
Right.
I think there's that moment when you're like, me?
Right.
I'm just a cook. You know, I drop fries every once in a while.
I remember when people started referring to me as a writer, I felt like an imposter.
Right?
Strange.
And great. And that probably means you really care about it, I think. If
maybe.
You do feel weird about it, like you feel like there's a responsibility with it.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm a very responsible podcaster. Like, it's a thing. It's not just a side sort of hustle.
You started yours when? It was over the summer?
Over the summer.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really just sort of a side sort of thing to do.
Yeah.
And some another way to spend time with my wife, who co-hosts with me from time to time. And a way for me to also be a little bit more social. So for me, it was really just working on my... my lack of social abilities.
You?
Me.
For yeah. Really?
Well, like when I'm
you
in front of a mic.
You don't seem like someone who has...
It's a weird thing. It's like it is, and my wife would tell you that if she was here. It's like if I'm in front of a mic or a camera, I have the ability to sort of like go into that mode.
Yes.
But generally speaking, I'm sitting like in my hotel room or in the back of a kitchen or if there's no mic or camera on, I'm a different
creature.
That's still
like your default. That's your default. Place.
It can be, for sure. Definitely a hotel room with video games has become a default place.
So is it, before we jump in on like the interview proper, is it odd for you now, having been interviewing people now for several months, is it odd for you to be on the receiving end of this thing?
It's not odd being the interviewer. I do love like just listening to people.
Yeah.
And for me, one of the things that we try to do is, I don't really want to hear necessarily about like what the next project is,
mm-hmm.
or you know what are we trying to sell, or what brand are you working with, or what's the newest opening. I just really want to talk to people in our industry about the things that they do that are really unrelated to the industry.
Yeah, you want to have a live conversation that goes where it goes.
Exactly, exactly. And sometimes it goes to whatever the project is, but I wanted to make sure that it was, you know, and long form is not really something that exists anywhere else, right? I mean, I'm getting used to like speaking in sound bites or interviews and it's blurb here.
Yeah.
And my publicist who's sitting next to me, she wants just 10 words, you know, for some recipe for some magazine.
Right.
And on a podcast, you get a chance to talk.
You know, it's funny. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but I started a blog several years ago and my first drafts for anything, including books, are like double what they should be.
Right.
And so I started writing blog posts and people would say, you know, and I would try to whittle them down to like, I thought 1,200 words was a good length that people would read.
Nice.
And people would say to me, oh, you know, your blog's long form.
Wow.
1,200 words. Like, what are we coming to?
Yes.
You know,
yes,
like, are people, and then I just started thinking, do people just not read this stuff? Like, should I just back off it? And you're right. I mean, the podcast thing, I think of it sort of like a beach ball. Like, if you can keep the beach ball up in the air, people will stay engaged.
That's true. Although, you know, I don't know if you're a fan of other podcasts.
Yes, very
much
so. But
I mean, there are some that are 2 or 3 hours long. That I don't understand. Like, that's to me where you got to make it a two-parter.
Or I feel like sometimes the podcasts that have like very rigid components, like that just repeat the same exact structure week after week, you start to anticipate that. And it, to me, I just fatigue on it. Things that I'm absolutely almost obsessed with.
Mm-hmm.
But no, when I did a thing before this with Jimmy Bradley from the Red Cat called The Front Burner. And when we decided we were going to do that show and like the 2 months leading up to it, I just started looking, like asking, I wasn't really a podcast listener before that. And then I went bananas, just looking for, you know, so I'm a huge fan of Marc Maron. I'm a huge fan of this thing called the Tennis Podcast, which are these two Brits.
Yeah.
Are you a tennis fan?
I'm a football fan.
Okay.
That's soccer to most of our listeners, probably.
Well,
but I love everything British. That's why I went,
it's a man and a woman, British journalists who cover tennis, and they do a highly entertaining, witty podcast that's very much punctuated by their sort of, you know, giving each other the business.
There you go. Yeah. So like a Men in Blazers sort of
or like a Thin Man movie. It's hugely entertaining. The Film Spotting, that these two guys
have
from
you been
Chicago,
on the podcast? Because it sounds like you're going to be a guest now.
On the Tennis Podcast?
Yeah.
No, I've never been on the Tennis Podcast.
Oh, well, I think we're working on that.
Well, we'll see. I got a lot going on.
You're in great shape, by the way.
Thank you.
We're not doing a video portion of this, but you're doing something. You're into some sort of fitness program. Right
I am. I'm a little self-conscious because you're now the second guest in a month who's called attention to this, and you and I don't even know each other before this.
Right, but I mean, you're pretty popular. I've seen pictures.
Thank you.
And I can tell that there's a healthy energy about you.
Well,
so what is it? What are we into right now?
You know, the thing I've done more than anything is walking.
Okay.
So I live in Westchester. I keep an office at WeWork here in New York at Irving Place. So I come into Grand Central most days. So I built into my day, unless it's horrible weather, a mile and a half each way.
Sure.
And then I walk, if I can have the time, I walk to every appointment, every interview, every meeting, every meal.
I do that when I'm in New York often.
Yeah.
And it's the easiest place to put 10 to 15 miles
a day
on your
easily
feet without
easily.
Even thinking
no.
about it.
If this you summer just, I was racking up 9, 10, 11,
exactly.
12 miles daily
exactly.
without just walking everywhere.
It's a hot tip.
I got a little crazy about it. Like I started, like I was working in Manhattan and if I have dinner at say Lilia in Williamsburg, I would walk the Williamsburg Bridge to go,
I don't think that's crazy.
Yeah.
And my publicist, Meredith, she knows. Like, I will do an event in Brooklyn and run back to Midtown.
Well, you're a marathon runner. You've done the New York Marathon, four times?
I just finished my fifth New York Marathon a couple weeks ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was my worst. It was my slowest. Always an amazing accomplishment at the end.
Yeah.
But I do, I mean, you know, I eat for a living and I like to eat.
Yeah.
That's kind of the problem. Yeah. That's why I probably got into this business. Yeah. So I do feel like, you know, 10 miles, if you can put 10 miles of walking / running, whatever, just moving a day, you can make some gains or some losses,
It's
I guess.
Crazy. Well, my friend, Michael White, who's obviously a well-known chef here in New York, who actually, there's an interview with Michael coming up next week.
Oh my gosh. But, I'm tuning in, by the way, because he's
or it may have aired before this one. But anyway, you people, subscribers will know. There's a reason
you're
to subscribe.
You're just destroying the continuity line.
But
right now.
It's okay. This isn't the X-Files. There's no mythology to this show. People will sort it out. But you know, Michael lost a ton of weight in the last few years. Just
I haven't
walking
seen recently.
Just
he
walking,
has.
Mostly walking. He walks everywhere.
Now, are you sort of obsessed with steps and miles digitally? Are you
I
like tracking
was
this?
Obsessed until I hit the mark I was shooting to hit.
Okay.
So I turned 50 in June, and about 3.5 months out from that, I decided I wanted to drop 25 pounds.
Right.
And then that happened faster than I could have imagined. And then I decided to go for 35, which I hit just after my birthday, like in July.
Congrats.
I hit that. Thank you.
Yeah.
And you know what? But more than the running or the walking, it was walking and running.
Sure.
And I saw a trainer once a week. It was diet. I did an 1800 calorie diet for about 4 months.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
How did you?
And that I was obsessed with.
Yeah. That's
I
tough.
Got an app that, it's MyFitnessPal, which Under Armour now owns. It's the most user-friendly app for Meredith's nodding. Have you seen it? It is the most user-friendly app for tracking food. It's amazing.
Okay.
Anything that has a, what do you call it? The barcode. That has a barcode. It's in their database.
That's
so you can just take a picture.
Truly.
Yeah, it's incredible. Amazing. And I was in ratios of fat to carbs to protein. Like, this is the stuff I worked with my trainer on as much as I did the exercise part. And people say, how'd you lose the weight? And I just say math. But I'm going to cut us off because you have now effectively jujitsu'd this interview.
We should do an hour
okay, like this, well, listen, and then you can run it on your show.
Just don't donate the first. Donate
we'll start
that 10
this,
minutes.
We'll start
to me.
This one over.
We'll run it as an ad for your podcast, and that works.
Okay, Richard.
Yeah.
First of all, it's great to meet you. Thank you for making the time for this. I don't even know how long. Why are you in New York?
You know, why am I in
this
New York
time?
On this trip? So I'm doing a couple of little morning shows. We just did the Harry Connick show. We're doing Rachel Ray tomorrow, and I'm doing your podcast, and I'm going to do an episode or two of my podcast, and I'm doing some holiday shopping.
Nice.
And that's just sort of, I'm not here for holiday shopping.
No.
That's just something that's happening while I'm
here.
I bought a funny hat. You can see it on Instagram.
Uh-huh.
But I was here last week, and I'm finding myself, you know, I think I counted, it's like 90 to 100 days a year that I'm in New York. I'm a native New Yorker, so it's always good to be home, so to speak.
Right. Now, when you say native New Yorker, did you grow up on Long Island, or were you born
in the city?
Are
you going to bridge and tunnel me right now?
No.
Is that, okay,
no, I'm asking,
gonna, okay.
I'm just asking you to,
Here's why I'm asking.
I'll be totally honest.
Sure.
I moved, having been born in New York, and then away from most of my childhood, I came back here for college.
Yes.
In New York City. I lived in New York City until 2.5 years ago and moved to Westchester. And my biography everywhere now, instead of saying he lives in New York City with his family, it says he lives in New York with his family.
Ah, there you go.
But I
exactly.
never copped to Westchester.
Oh.
So I wasn't bridge and tunneling you, but I was wondering what you meant by...
That would
native
be fine.
New Yorker,
I would just
if you're
rally.
Referring to the city or the state.
Yeah, I would just be, you would be rallying all of my New Jersey, Long Island fans anyway. And they're a tough group. No, I grew up on Long Island, so Strong Island. And and worked in Manhattan at Danielle for a while. And, you know, staged, of course, and then went to school upstate in the CIA and Poughkeepsie. So sort of all, every which way, every tunnel and every bridge I've gone through and over.
So can we go through... Can we go through your beginnings a little bit?
Yeah, they're pretty, I mean, from the food perspective, you know, I was sort of, I love to eat, right?
Always?
Always, like to a detriment. Like you were talking about losing some weight. I mean, I've lost 50 or 60 pounds over the last 10 years or so. So, I mean, I just always, as a kid, not really knowing it, but just kind of always enjoyed food, which is like, I guess most people.
No. Did that coincide with your auditioning for television? That timing seems almost to line up exactly with you're going on Top Chef.
Was that
a motivator?
Me just loving food or
the weight loss.
The weight loss. No, actually, if you go back, so like my first couple of television appearances, Iron Chef America, like 2004, Top Chef, I think, was filmed in 2006. I'm quite heavier, you know? Probably somewhere halfway between my sort of weight loss was those appearances. And then I thought I had lost a lot of weight, and then I saw myself on television. I was like, oh, I'm only halfway there.
Right, that's a good gut check for you.
I will say
you.
That is a
like
massive.
Nothing like being on camera, yeah.
For everything, for your personality, yes. For just, you see yourself on television for the first time, and especially in a show like Top Chef, where it's a continuous sort of like marathon, and you're like, oh, there's a lot of things I need to work on. And one of them was certainly health and fitness, for sure.
So growing up, you say you loved food, but I know I've read, maybe it was in your first book, that you talk about, you know, eating SpaghettiOs, and the only chef you knew was Chef Boyardee. What was your level of food savvy as a kid?
Yeah,
or did
not
you just
very
like
much.
Anything?
I liked anything and everything, and I liked eating.
Yeah.
I didn't have an understanding of sort of like what was maybe great food or good food.
Sure,
but I loved I just sort of loved eating and sitting in front of the TV and eating some SpaghettiOs and watching Scooby-Doo.
Uh-huh.
I remember, I think I ate like 7 grilled cheese sandwiches once watching like a Scooby-Doo marathon when I was like 11. Man, that was a good day, by the way. I did nothing. I came home from school, I sat on the couch and ate 7 grilled cheese sandwiches and watched Scooby-Doo.
Nice.
Yeah, you know when they rip off the mask at the end?
Yeah,
and, so I was, that's Scooby-Doo for anyone. Spoiler alert, the end of Scooby-Doo.
Spoiler alert, they would have gotten away for it if it wasn't for those meddling kids.
Yeah, it's always the first person that you think is the villain that actually ends up being the villain. No, it's actually usually the henchman. We're going off topic right here. I always loved eating. And then I had some fast food roots. My first job was at a little restaurant called McDonald's.
Yes.
Some people have heard of it. And, I was the poissonnier there.
Yeah, I've seen this. What do you mean by that? There was not actually a fish station at McDonald's.
No, I'm being a wise ass because, can I say ass? I've said it
you
twice.
You can say anything on this show.
I worked the fish station there. So, of course, in the classic French lexicon, that's called poissonnier.
But you actually did say you made the filet.
I did.
What was the McDonald's iteration?
The filet of fish.
Filet of fish.
Yeah. Squirt of tartar sauce and a slice of cheese, which is a little controversial. I don't know. Maybe you can ask Mario Batali how he feels about cheese and fish. But I guess what's more controversial is it fish? Really?
Well, that's funny. But I don't know about you. Having collaborated on a number of Italian cookbooks.
Yes.
I think that the whole fish and cheese thing is actually, I don't know who first wrote it. I think it's a myth.
I agree.
Are so many chefs who either there's Parmesan in the sauce or something. I'm talking about fish dishes or shelf scallop dishes.
Sure.
Or that's their little secret trick that doesn't go in the cookbook, but they do it.
I 100%. Linguine and clams need some Parm. That's all.
That's
I'm
an
saying.
Aside.
Yes.
Yeah. So you had this job at McDonald's.
Yeah. And, without knowing it, I sort of liked the structure of it. What I really fell in love with first, before I fell in love with good food, was the camaraderie of a kitchen.
Even there.
And, I think my first day, for the first half of the day, I was a cashier. Mm-hmm. And I just could not deal with like the, looking people in the eye and, making change and all the basic things that a cashier has to do. So I was like, I want to go hang out with the cool kids in the back.
Right.
Because they were all like the high school football players and like bad, asses. And I wanted to be back there, even though I was none of those things. And that's kind of where it started. And then I just always sort of was, from there, I just started working in different restaurants.
Yeah.
Like a slow build from there. Like literally the next fast food place, a place that's a click better. Oh, this one's making club sandwiches. Oh, wow, there's a steak.
This is all through your high school years.
This is like high school and even like college, in and out of college, and just sort of trying to find my way until eventually I started working in places where I realized that it wasn't just camaraderie and sort of the craft and a job, but there was a little bit of art to it.
Yeah.
And I always had that somewhere deep in the recesses of my mind, this sort of artistic sort of desire.
What else did you do as a kid? Were you into sports? Were you on any teams?
Yeah.
I've actually been wondering, leading up to this interview, if you did anything performance related, whether theater or a band or something.
Yeah.
So what else was going on in your life as a kid?
Kind of all of those things.
Yeah.
Definitely mainly sports, and I think
organized
that's
or like pickup games?
Every which way. I mean, this was before there were video games.
Yeah.
And they would have these games where you would roll dice to play. Instead of like playing a baseball video game, you would cards and roll dice and look at charts. Like, kids, that's going to blow.
You mean like you roll a so-and-so and that's a single?
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I played those games.
People under a certain age still, even though I just explained it, have no idea what we're talking about.
We're going to have to put up a picture of like Stratomatic or APA baseball.
I totally forgot about this, but did you ever play this game? I grew up in Florida, so maybe it only existed there. It was like football or something, but you took a pencil.
Yeah.
With the point down, mm-hmm. and you like forced it onto the table, you had like a sheet of paper.
Yeah.
And however far like the streak went,
oh,
like the line that the pencil made, like that was your...
That's the how many yards
yeah,
you made.
Yeah, yeah,
oh my God, no, but like yeah. we should play that later. And that could be a little digital component
we can
of this
ruin the
podcast.
Desk here. Yeah, okay.
But it was all, yeah, so I mean sports. And then I played, you know, anything that I could. It was mainly Little League baseball at that time.
Uh-huh.
It was, you know, my kids are so blessed right now. They get to play every sport,
sure.
you know, all season long. But yeah, sort of just, I loved sports. I loved statistics.
You did.
You know, I did. And I'm still looking for that moment. I do think that, you know, something that's going to happen for me soon is making that sort of like the connection between like advanced stats and sabermetrics in sports to the food world. I think is going to be...
You're waiting for these planets to align
You know, I'm not really waiting. I'm trying to push these planets together uh-huh. necessarily, but I do think that there's something there. I do think that we in the restaurant business are not looking at all the in-between numbers. Like mm-hmm. we are looking at sales and we're yeah. looking at covers and we're looking at these things, but we're not truly, you know, getting all the metrics on our cooks or servers or the operations of a restaurant. Sorry to go way sidebar.
But how do you mean? Do you mean that super literally in actual data, or do you feel like there's something almost more abstract or like poetic that's lost, almost like an Einstein level
yeah.
observation?
I mean, I think originally I'm talking about true data.
Yeah,
and then I think with the data, then you might find some of that art and poetry, which I think is an interesting
some
way
like
to
philosophical
you might,
thing
right.
that people are missing.
I mean,
in the quest for profitability.
This is great. We're obviously connecting. We have great chemistry. I just want to make
you.
That clear.
Thank you.
But like, if you GPS, like you're talking about your steps and tracking that. I mean, if you truly did that with all of your cooks in a
sure.
kitchen. I tell you what, you'd have a really interesting graph at the end of the day, knowing how many times your grill cook went to the walk-in and how many times they went to the host stand and
right.
All of these sort of things. Now, I don't just mean that in a big brother sort of way, like, oh, we want to know what our employees are doing all the
sure.
time. But I'm talking about, well, you know, where can we save some time? Where can we save some steps?
Totally.
How much time did you spend, you know, peeling those Brussels sprout leaves, whatever it is.
Or did you carry as much back from the walk-in as you possibly could have to save yourself two other trips there?
Exactly. So I think there yeah. are a lot of hidden numbers, and it's something that I want to, in 2018 here, sort of dive into.
So before we move on from your childhood.
Yes.
Were you sports-wise, were you super competitive?
You know, I just loved it. No, I wasn't really competitive, which is going to sound surprising to people who have watched me like compete as
yeah.
a chef on television, because I think people think I'm ultra competitive. But as a kid, I just loved the game. I mean, it sounds mm-hmm. like such a cliche, like for the love of the game. Like but I did. I just loved playing. Like I still do.
Yeah.
And even to a fault, actually, I think in my food, you know, in the food competition space, I think that was my flaw
yeah.
early on. I didn't really care if I beat Mario Batali on Iron Chef. I didn't necessarily really care if I won Top Chef the
yeah.
first time. I didn't have the desire to be a winner. I just liked being there. When
yeah.
I didn't win those things, I was more upset that there wasn't a game the next day than
right.
it was about not winning,
sure.
if that makes sense.
Totally.
Because in sport, you get used to losing. It's just kind of how it is. But that was sort of tough for me to figure out mentally. Like,
now,
you have to actually try and figure out how to win these things.
Right. What about the performance thing I asked about? Was there anything? Because you seem like, obviously, to anyone who's watched you the last however many years, you seem like a natural performer. You seem very comfortable in the public eye. You seem you're obviously very quick.
Oh.
You know, was there an element of this in your childhood?
You know, again, this
beyond
is,
sports, which in its own
sure.
way is performance, right?
You know, I could, my stepdad was always in the film industry. As far as like, he was an editor, he was a cameraman. So there,
oh, really?
So there was a part of that in my upbringing, and he also just loved classic films. So like, I grew up in a very sort of humble sort of. You know, small home, but like our posters were, you know, Clockwork Orange and all of these, you know, sort of classic films.
Yeah.
And I remember there's this old time-lapse film called Koryaanisqatsi, which
oh,
is basically...
Sure.
Okay, yeah. So like that was like, I was forced, you know, my dad, that would be like this is Friday
Orange,
night.
Like
right.
with your eyes,
right.
Like
you're 7 years old,
open.
You're going to watch
yeah.
a double feature of Clockwork Orange and Koryaanisqatsi.
Wow.
So it was there. And then, you know, I did do a little bit of like, you know, almost like public service sort of little acting things as a kid for like whatever company my dad was working for.
Okay.
But real minimal. I was in a play in elementary school.
But it wasn't a passion.
Not a passion. As a matter of fact, I wish it was. I wish actually now, you know, that I'm, you know, trying to mentor and, you know, try and, you know, teach my kids, you know, to sort of grab onto a passion early.
Yeah.
I wish it was, because it obviously sort of worked out that way for me.
Sure.
But I had to learn it. I think being a chef sort of took away all of those things. You know, I still came up in these sort of old school kitchens where there was no like, you know, the open kitchen, and you just did whatever the chef told you to do. And you didn't really talk. Matter of fact, if you were talking or sort of being dynamic in a kitchen, you were kind of a fool, right? I mean, you know, these kitchens. So I've had to learn that. If you went back and watched like my first local TV bit, which was like a lobster salad in Atlanta, I have it on VHS tape somewhere. Yeah. I was horrible. I didn't look at the camera once, and it was literally, I was so serious, and it was just really bad television.
Wow.
So I've learned, I'm still learning, to be honest. I don't want
you, you have know, things I'm, that when you see yourself today, even you're making mental notes and
everything. I mean, you know, I'm at a point where now it's like I'm lucky and blessed enough to host a thing here or there, but I'm still learning. I'm still trying to figure it out. And I think that's been an amazing sort of like hill to try and climb is like, I think I can be as good as Guy Fieri or Rachel Ray or Alton Brown.
Yeah.
But that's a lot of work. Those people are a lot better than you think they are.
Yeah.
Not you personally, but maybe some of your audience at what they do than you might even think.
Yeah. Yeah. Last question on childhood. Again, what kind of student were you?
So, wow. You know, it's tough because again, I just, my youth, something, you know, you ever want to just go back and like do some things over?
Do I ever want to just go back? I want to go back. Forget my childhood. I want to go back to last week.
When I was in elementary school, I was in this thing, like, I think it was called More Able Learners.
Okay.
And that was about the end of like me being at the top tier of the academic sort of pyramid.
So that was like a gifted child program?
It was kind of like a gifted child program. Now, you know, I was also the best baseball pitcher on the Little League team, but we sucked. You know, like, so when you're like the best on a horrible team, that doesn't really mean very much.
So you got into the gifted program, and then you were early, sort of like,
and then fell out of it.
Remedial, like the bottom of the class.
You know, bottom of the class. I, you know, by the time I, you know, did get to high school, I did just fall into some of the, you know, the social trappings of, you know, trying to be, you know, not the biggest nerd or the biggest loser, and trying to just sort of like most people do, trying to fit in. And, you know, I wish I would have focused more academically. Now I can't get enough time. As a matter of fact, when we think about personal pain points, this morning I was, you know, when you listen to podcasts,
I
listen to them on 2x speed. Do you?
No.
I listen to them 2x.
Wow.
Because I need more information. I don't have enough information. And I feel like in my life, to be honest with you, I'm constantly behind the ball. Like I'm just trying to climb up this hill and I'm behind and I have to do things faster and harder. And so that's my
like
newest
speed
thing.
Reading. Do you know how to speed read? Remember speed reading?
Yeah.
Do you know how to do that?
I've tried it. Like,
you have?
You know who's not really good to speed read? Kerouac. No, yeah.
I'm completely the like when I think it's because I'm a writer first and foremost, but when I read something that's quote unquote real writing, I sort of want to like luxuriate in the language. So I'm actually an incredibly slow, unproductive reader. And it's sort of the same thing for me with podcasts, especially interview style. Like I'll actually listen to things 2 and 3 times.
Yeah.
Sometimes. It's not efficient.
I read slower than I listen.
But you're giving me, now you're making me...
I'm getting you anxious? I'm sorry.
No, no, no. You're making me want to like maybe listen to things at 2x. Because then I wouldn't have this backlog.
Yeah. Listen, I do have the ability to sort of make everyone around me anxious.
No, I'm not anxious.
As my publicist shakes her head.
Meredith is nodding.
Yeah. But no, I mean, listen, if I'm on a treadmill or if I'm running, like it's a podcast, sometimes it's music. But even now, like I'm listening to music and I'm like, oh, I'm wasting my time. I need more information.
Right.
So sorry to take you deep inside the
No, this is great. This is great. So tell me about your transition. You start cooking, you kind of start working up to more and more serious restaurants, and then you make a decision to go to the Culinary Institute.
Yes. So literally like one step at a time, mom and pop bistro, you know, Italian, French, steakhouse, fast food, like every little level that I've worked in.
Yeah.
And at one point, like I noticed, I was working in a steakhouse and there were a lot of chefs in there that had their names on their jacket, yeah. which was the script from the Culinary Institute of America, mm-hmm. which later I realized if you're wearing your culinary school jacket in a kitchen, yeah. you probably weren't a great culinary school student, if that's what you got going right. for you. But then I realized that, wow, it wasn't just a craft. It wasn't just like work. There was yeah. an art to it. And I just started becoming obsessed in like getting to the culinary school, getting to the Culinary Institute of America, applying, getting in, which was actually a struggle for me because I wasn't a great student. Yeah, I remember I had to like take a math test. Like they don't do that for everyone, only for people.
I've never heard this in an interview about an academic.
I guess it's embarrassing. That's interesting. Yeah, usually it's just like you have to tell them you worked at a bagel shop for a year and that you have money.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. That's what most people say. Yeah. Yeah.
And for me, it was like, oh, well, you know, you have to come take this, I have to take this test. And I did, and I passed, and then, I literally didn't have, I just saved enough money working in a little Italian restaurant.
Yeah.
And then went off with it and loved it. And because it was so hard to get there, and I think this helps because I am sort of feel like I'm always behind the ball, because it took me some time to get there, I had to save money, I just fell in love with it. Like I literally one time at the CIA fell asleep in the library, and they shut down the library with me in the library.
Locked in.
And wow. I was like, I came up from my books and I was like, oh, they shut this place down. And I luckily they left the door open from the inside. So I was able to leave. Obviously I'm here with you. That would have been a horrible thing if I was still there. But yeah.
They might have named a building after you. Maybe the library.
Yeah. Yeah. at the same time though, I also had a part-time job in that library and I would fall asleep downstairs while on shift wow. while I worked there because I was so tired.
What did
so
you
that's
love
not that's the other side of
what did you love about cooking school?
I loved the formality of it and the structure of it and
we like, chef and all that
I
stuff.
I loved all that. That absolute toque and the neckerchief you and all the stuff that right now
bring it on.
I can't stand any of that stuff.
Really?
But I love the I love that you couldn't miss a school, that it was like there was a military school element of it. Yeah. I kind of needed that. I knew that I wasn't, that I sort of just wasn't on the right track, So I needed that structure and I loved that about culinary school. And the fact that then in sort of hindsight, once you get out into the industry, you don't have an hour to read about carrots when you're on the line.
Yeah.
So like all of those that time that I spent in the library and watching, the VCR on how to butcher a whole pig or whatever that was stuff that you can't do in the real world really. So that I utilized that time.
Yeah. So what's the first thing you do after cooking school?
After cooking school, I work at, I sort of do my internship at the French Laundry.
That was an internship.
That was my internship. Okay. I stayed on a little bit longer than like my official internship.
How'd you score that?
Totally by luck. I did what I think most people should do if there's any aspiring sort of, chefs that listen to your podcast.
Lots of them.
Find the 10 people that you just absolutely love and respect and want to work for, and you just send them letters. And, and luckily for me, it was, Eric Repair and Charlie Trotter and Thomas Keller, who, by the way, at that time in the, early and mid-90s, no one really knew who Thomas Keller was. And one of my instructors just said, hey, this guy's going to happen.
Yeah.
Send this guy a letter too. And it was David Burke and all of these sort of heroes of mine now and people that, I can call friends and, Trotter, rest in peace. But, I got to choose actually, where I went, and it was the French Laundry was the furthest away from New York at the time in Napa Valley. So I decided I'd go on a California adventure, and that changed my life.
Yeah. How so? How did you find that restaurant at that time?
Incredibly intimidating. I had staged at like Oriole and had spent some time in some really nice kitchens, but this was as close as, I had seen at that moment to like a 3 Michelin star restaurant, before that was even a thing.
Yeah.
The structure of it, again, the military aspect of it, not just the recipes, but the formality of sort of like, the line cook, chef de partie, Comey sort of situation. I lived about 8 miles from the restaurant. I bought a bike for like $40. It was a Schwinn. I would bike back and forth at like 3 a.m. and get home at like, whatever it was, 10 at night.
Yeah.
And some of those trips, to be honest with you, I would be crying the whole way back because I was just getting destroyed by like my, I was going to say my superior officer, which is what it seemed like,
chef de partie.
Yeah. Yeah. Early on, especially, and eventually I figured it out, but
what are your memories of Keller? I mean, cause I'm trying to put myself in the mindset at that time, right? If you talk to people who knew Thomas before the French Laundry, like when he was in New York at Raquel, and even before that, you say, what was he like? And they describe him the way he is described today. It's like he's, you know, oh, he was always cleaning. He was very intense.
Yeah.
You know, he could do anything you could do and do it better. You know, like all the way back, right? But at the time you're describing, before he had really exploded the way that restaurant took him to this sort of insane level of success, to go there without the benefit of having seen videos on the internet and profiles and all of this, I'm just wondering what the effect was like. I sort of imagine it in my mind's eye, not quite like this, but almost like Clarice Starling, you know, seeing Dr. Lecter for the first time, you know, but that it would have that level of intensity. What was it like when you first, do you remember your first sighting or encounter with him?
Yeah, I mean, one, everything you said is absolutely true. You know, I wasn't quite terrified. I wouldn't say that, but there was sort of a sense of, there's a Darth Vader sort of element.
There's a mystique.
To it. There's a mystique to it. And in a good way, by the way, I'm a Darth Vader fan. I just want to make
that
clear.
Yeah. No, but it's like chefs were like gunslingers back then. Like you heard stuff.
Exactly.
But you didn't have any visual evidence until you got in front of this person yourself.
And with TK, it wasn't, you didn't hear things. That's kind of probably the most alarming part of it is that he's a very quiet chef, and certainly at that time. And he leads by example, is what you're saying. And he is always cleaning and he has his tasks that time, early on in the French Laundry days, where he was rolling the torchon or cutting the salmon every day, and that was the thing that he did.
Yeah.
And if he called you over to just hold the cheesecloth while he was wrapping the foie gras torchon, like it was you were blessed, you know, like little things like that, where you were truly the sort of mentor apprenticeship thing, like doesn't exist as much as it did maybe back in those days. But it was also intimidating, incredibly intimidating, and not just because he was an amazing chef, but because you have to understand that, you know, the 50 other cooks there. Like Grant Achatz was my chef to partie. You know, like, you know, the Eric Siebold was the, you know, was sous chef. I mean, these are all people who have won, you know, accolades and awards.
Everyone there wanted to be a great chef.
I'm a podcaster, just to be clear.
No, you know, what, stop.
But I'm just saying, you know, it was intense and it changed my life. I will say this, that, you know, you go to culinary school and you get a degree, but I became a chef at the French Laundry.
Yeah. It upped your ambition?
It just made me realize that when I left there, and again, this is only a couple of months and not, just doing all of the sort of morning work prep and basically all the, you know, sort of grunt work, if you will, that I was a chef, that you couldn't give me an ingredient that I wouldn't know, you know, I would know what to do with it.
So it changed your life in that eventually you went from kind of almost crying on the way home to feeling like I can hang with this. I can do this.
I mean, you know, the chef means boss and leader. And like when I then went back to culinary school, I felt like I could lead people because I had seen so many different things, whether it was just ingredients or techniques or just again structure and format. And absolutely changed my life. Best thing I could have ever have done. And for anyone who's listening, like take that chef, if you can, and you have the means to sort of support yourself.
Right.
Work for the hardest place you can early on in your career.
Great. So what came after that? Was Danielle after that?
Danielle was pretty... I came back to school. I finished up school. I stayed on and did a sort of fellowship program at the CIA, which is another great moment of my
life. So you worked
in
one of the restaurants there?
I worked in the fish kitchen.
Okay.
So I basically spent a year after that. Yeah, it was a year. Just every morning waking up and cutting fish for a whole year.
Was it the fish kitchen of the Escoffier room or American Bounty?
It's, again, this is old school, so I think they've changed things, but it was called K7. So every kitchen had a number.
Okay.
And it was K7. It was just the fish kitchen.
Okay.
And this was a moment where every, you know, in your first year of training, you'd go through like basic skills and then you'd get to like the meat kitchen and then you'd get to the fish kitchen.
Got
and
it.
Usually the chefs in that kitchen were hardcore. My fellowship instructor was Corky Clark.
Okay.
Who was, you know, well known and like just an, you know, icon at that school and like a military background.
Yep.
And just, again, I sort of needed that structure. Yeah. He was an amazing mentor. And then I got the ability there to sort of start to teach people, which was just the best part of that fellowship was not just learning how to cut whatever fish came through the door or order the fish, but it was, you know, speaking to 50 students every, you know, week and a half and getting a chance to teach them about fish and cutting fish.
So when you are at the point of finally saying goodbye to the CIA, what sort of is in your head at that time in terms of who you saw yourself maturing into, say, 5-10 years down the line? Was there a picture in your mind of the food you thought you'd be doing at that time, of what you wanted for yourself? Did you want to own your own restaurant at that point?
Sure. I mean, you know, I remember when I just went to culinary school, the goal was something like be an executive chef by the time you're, you know, 35 right. or something like that, yep. like 10 years down the road. I expedited that pretty quickly. I at that moment you just become who you work for. So like I was just a French laundry robot. I mean, yeah. I'm not going to lie and say that I had my vision for what I wanted to be. I wanted to make beurre monté and I wanted to make infused thyme oil and I wanted to serve, you know, lamb sweetbreads in a tiny little pile on a giant white plate. Yeah. And, you know, and
it's almost impossible to work for a place like that if you decide to stay with it and not become that, right? It imprints
on you. And so then I followed it up with a job at Danielle for a little while. Again, I wanted to stay in the classic French repertoire. And at that time in New York, I mean, you know, there were four or five big chefs and it was either you're going to go work for Danielle, Eric Ripert, or Jean-Georges, you know, maybe Boulet.
Was Greg Kuhn's still cooking?
Greg Kuhn's, I think, had just probably left
just pushed off
the L'Espinasse. Yeah. And, but like, man, these names, by the way, get me excited when I talk about them because, I mean, you know, I know them. I always get upset when like younger cooks don't know who like Greg Kuhn's is or like
it's crazy.
It is crazy because they, you know, we wouldn't be here without them.
Yeah. So what brings you from that job? You end up moving down to Atlanta.
I moved down to Atlanta.
What precipitated that?
I'm going to give you the elevator sort of pitch here is I met a girl. I had a relationship with this girl. Her dad was a restaurateur.
Okay.
I did know the whole time that I needed to expedite my career and that I was a couple years behind and that the goal was going to be to run a place and, you know, eventually be the chef somewhere.
Were you really behind or is this just this thing you've already referred to of you, you know, like listening to podcasts at double the speed?
Yeah. No, I mean, I was a couple years. I mean, listen, I didn't go to culinary school when I was 18. I went when I was in my, you know, early mid-20s.
Yeah.
So I felt like I was behind age-wise.
Yeah.
Whether that's true or not, I'm not sure. But I knew that I was not going to be able to grind it out with the French Laundry or Restaurant Danielle or be one of these guys that spent 10 years to become the chef of, you know, Café Boulou Montreal or whatever.
Right.
And that sounds probably horrible, but because that's an amazing position.
Yeah, but that's not what you were...
In those moments, you look at the roster, so to speak, and you're like, oh, I'm behind 19 people on this list.
Yes.
I'm going to have to go make things happen by myself.
Right. Great.
So I end up in Atlanta and, you know, get thrown into the fire of eventually being an executive chef of what at first was a fish restaurant. And I realize I'm a horrible business person. I'm an okay chef.
Yeah.
And that the rest of the world isn't upper Manhattan, you know, and the Upper East Side of Manhattan and Napa Valley.
No.
And that's a hard lesson to learn when you can't buy foie gras and caviar and truffles and all you know is foie gras, caviar, and truffles.
Right. When did you do this stage that you did at El Bulli?
El Bulli comes after I close a restaurant called Blaze, which, you know, again, I had a 30-course menu. I was just a silly kid that, again, you know, papers started to write about the restaurant. It was becoming nationally known. It felt great to sort of, you know, get that sort of those accolades. It didn't work out business-wise. You know, I mean, a 30-course menu in, you know, in Atlanta in the 90s wasn't that great. And also, that sounds like I'm making an excuse and blaming Atlanta. I also wasn't...
Well...
I wasn't quite skilled to pull that off, and the restaurant wasn't built for that. And
well, you also look at you know someone like Gunter Seeger, right?
Who couldn't
keep going there. I mean, I'm not putting Atlanta down either, but it just doesn't seem to be like what at the time anyway the city wanted.
Sure, and I just you know again, it's for me it's important just to be self-reflective and also just whatever you're dealing with in your life, look in the mirror.
Yeah.
You're probably 75% right about other people, you know, being a part of it, but 25% it is probably you. So all I'm saying is that, you know, part of Gunter Seeger not working in Atlanta was Gunter Seeger.
Yeah.
And I love Gunter Seeger.
Yeah, yeah.
And part of me not working out in Atlanta was my own fault too.
Well said.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a break, or we're going to take a break.
Do we have an ad? Can I read it?
I don't have an ad.
Oh, my gosh.
They let me on the first season with no sponsor.
Oh, my gosh. No, I can do a fake one if you want.
Hey, everyone. These really well. Go ahead.
Yeah. What are we going to do here? Hey, everyone. Listen, I hope you love something as much as I do. Do you love donuts? Because I love donuts. But do you live maybe somewhere in the middle of the country and you want one of these new Wiley Dufresne yuzu and peanut butter donuts, but you can't get it? Or maybe you want that buttermilk and huckleberry donut that's all the rage up in Seattle. Well, listen, you can get all these donuts delivered to you tomorrow by ordering donuts from my new company. It's called Dronuts. That's right. Donuts and drones come together to deliver you a dozen donuts whenever you want. Starting now, a dozen donuts is $7,000, and you can only order them if you live 400 yards from my house. But Dronuts.
And what's that promotional code, Richard?
The promotional code is #Dronuts, It's not a real thing. Thanks for letting me play. I appreciate it.
Thanks for being here. We're obviously talking with Richard Blaze, and we'll be right back after this break. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a penny bright, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night. My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
And we are back talking with Richard Blaze. So, Richard, can we? I'd love to just talk for a minute about your stage at El Bulli. I don't know if I'm right or not. I'm assuming that was a really important thing in your life.
It was an amazing thing in my life, and it was an absolute accident, you know? So a lot of cooks of that time are always like, how did you get into El Bulli? How did you spend some time there?
Yeah.
And I literally just closed a restaurant, like I had mentioned.
Yeah.
Or actually, it was before I was opening a restaurant, but I had some downtime, and I was like, I'm just going to throw on a backpack and go to Spain. And this was like, again, it was post my time at Danielle.
Okay.
When people just started talking about this restaurant in Spain.
When it was just kind of
that was making
breaking.
Like coconut milk ravioli and like just, you know, doing, and like sous vide was just becoming a thing.
Right.
Like it was a really like big moment.
It's so funny you mentioned the ravioli, because I remember, wasn't there a ravioli there that like you busted it open and like the pasta
there was like a
melded into the sauce or something.
There was like a caramel ravioli. There was all, you know, but it was this sort of like, oh wow, that's not even, I don't even know if that's food.
Right.
Like the flavor combinations are so wild. And so I went to Barcelona. That's me throwing on my Catalonian accent.
Yeah.
And you know, I just climbed the hill basically, because it's a big spiral mountain.
Uh-huh.
And I was just taking a picture of the restaurant, the logo at the front of the restaurant, just literally going up there like a tourist. And Ferran Adrià walked by.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, hi, chef. And, you know, can I see the kitchen?
Do you speak Spanish?
Not at all. Yeah, I did learn the word valet. It's just what anyone would tell me, which just I think means kind of like move it and okay, let's go.
Right.
So that was the word I learned in that kitchen. And he invited me in, and luckily someone had just walked out or left or something like that. So they could use a set of hands, and I just jumped in and ended up staying there for like a week or so. Not a long time at all.
Yeah. This was technically what we would call a stage.
This is a stage.
Yeah.
But again, it was sort of an off-the-cuff stage. It wasn't set up. It wasn't for a full season. I had to get back to open this restaurant, and I just luckily, again, climb up the mountain, because you never know who you're going to see
when
you knock on the door. And again, another sort of life-changing sort of moment, because now I was at that point just sort of like, again, this sort of French cuisine robot.
Yeah.
And now I'm seeing something that, like, I don't even remember seeing fire in the kitchen. There were just weird things like that. Like where someone who's never worked in Europe before, you're like, oh wow. Yeah. They just do things differently. They eat later, just little things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty amazing, you know, hammering out, you know, rabbit brains, you know, for 8 hours a day, and, you know, taking the trash out at, you know, 6 a.m. because the hours are so late there. But it definitely impacted me.
And did this kind of light the sort of molecular fire for you?
It did. I would have to say that the trip to El Bulli, accompanied by like the fact that some of these people that I was working alongside of at like the French Laundry were starting to become popular. And there's like, there is this competitive sort of push with when you have a group like that, and, you know, people like Grant were starting to get accolades, and I think it was probably Trio at the time. And you're like, oh wow, people are starting to do things around me. They're not just the sous chef or the second sous chef, or they're not just opening up the outpost of the bistro.
Right.
They're starting to do their own things. So it definitely started pushing me towards, you know, wanting to do my own things and not only just, you know, doing something that I've learned from someone else, but trying to be a little bit more creative.
Yeah. Now, I remember when I first saw you on Top Chef, right?
Yes.
Liquid nitrogen. Mm. Like, this was, these are the things that I associate with the first times that I kind of saw
sure,
you.
Yeah.
I'd love your thought on this. Where do you, at this point in time, how do you look at the whole notion of molecular gastronomy? Do you look at that as a category unto itself or a genre unto itself?
Am I speaking in, like, right now, in the moment?
Yeah.
I don't think it's a category in itself anymore. I actually never thought it was a category in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the weird thing about molecular gastronomy is that I don't think you find too many people calling themselves molecular gastronomists.
Yeah.
You know, there might've been a scientist who came up with it and might've put that term on a few people, but I always, you know, I'm a New Yorker who grew up in the, you know, 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
It's like hip hop to me. Like, it's hip hop, not rap music, you know? So like, whatever molecular gastronomy is, it's not rap, it's hip hop, you know, which is maybe now you could say modernist cuisine or whatever other word you want
right.
to throw on it. I don't think it's got a proper tag, but the idea of using science and technology to make food more delicious.
Yeah.
That's easy to understand.
Right.
The term is not a great term, right?
Yeah.
And I guess whether it's rock and roll or jazz, it's kind of similar with a lot of art forms.
Well, it's weird. I would actually even connect, you know, I think a lot of times, you know, journalists are kind of the villains in this
Ooh.
Kind of thing. Well, no, yeah. of needing a handle or a catch-all to refer to something that's going on for ease of reporting,
sure.
right? So then a lot of people who are doing very kind of disparate things but have this one element of it in common get grouped together, right?
I think
that to me is what Nouvelle Cuisine was that. California Cuisine, I think, was that. I mean, is there really such a thing?
Right.
You know, or were there just a bunch of people all of a sudden who, yes, they were grilling maybe not as, you know, the sauce went under the food, you know?
Yeah, sure.
But is that really a cuisine?
Yeah, I mean, you know? You're a writer, so you call it villainous. I would say, you know.
Well, I don't mean villain. I
sure,
mean, they're
sure.
the.
But it helps. I mean, the fact
culpable.
Is also. The
fact they're
is, though,
culpable.
It helps.
We're
because
culpable.
If it wasn't yeah. for the term molecular gastronomy, then yeah. I'm probably not casted on a television show looking for a molecular gastronomist, you know? So
yeah.
I think, again, you can get upset or who came up with the name and it doesn't
yeah.
work. But I'm also not the type of, like, I don't get upset when people say it.
Yeah.
It used to bother me a little bit, but I don't anymore because it's something that people just, they know it, they've heard it. It's not their fault that they think
it's molecular
gastronomy.
And as you were just honest enough to say, it's not an unhelpful thing.
No.
To people who are part of the movement.
Yeah, so this was unintentional, but I will tell you this. When people say, you know, oh, you only cook with liquid nitrogen, it's not really the case.
I wasn't trying to imply that.
No, not
yeah.
at all.
yeah.
But if you and I are competing on a television show
yes.
and you run for salt and pepper and vinegar and I run for a tank of liquid nitrogen, the camera's going to follow me
yeah.
to the nitrogen tank. It's just, it's more...
Especially at the time you
TV.
Were doing it. I mean, I don't think there'd been anyone like doing that on that show prior to you.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think there, Marcel was a character on that who
oh, right.
did
yeah,
foams.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
I was,
yeah, I forgot
you
about
know,
that.
And, you know, so I certainly don't have a problem being sort of lumped into like one of the people who
yeah,
helped
yeah.
popularize it.
Yeah.
But again, you know, at the time, I'm not doing anything that wasn't being done at
yeah.
El Bulli or
yeah.
Fat Duck or, you know, any of those types of yeah. restaurants.
So what was the motivation for you to be on that show? What was the primary factor for you?
Again, a happy accident, which seems to be a theme of
yeah.
this podcast. There's a lot of happy accidents. And I answered a phone at another little restaurant that I was working at, just sort of a rebound little place in Atlanta. And they were like, hey, this is Top Chef. We're casting for the show. I didn't apply. I didn't throw out a reel.
Yeah.
They were casting in Atlanta. I think at the time, one of my restaurants was getting reviewed. And I'm imagining, this is also fictitious, but that the casting director was in their hotel lobby drinking some coffee, having a croissant.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fancy hotel.
Uh-huh.
And they're looking at the review
yeah.
of me in goggles and gloves, you know, blasting yeah. an ingredient with liquid nitrogen. They're like, let's give this guy a call.
Yeah.
And when they called, I thought that they were looking for a judge because, you know, I had a massive ego at that time.
Right.
Like all chefs do a little bit. And I was like, oh yeah, I'll come judge your show. And they're like, no, we want you to compete. And that was another gut check moment for me where I was like, oh, you know, I've run some restaurants and I'm starting to become known. I've already been on Iron Chef. Who are
mm-hmm.
these people that think they want me to compete on this show, Top Chef? But it was a gut check thing. Again, look in the mirror. You know, if you don't do it or you're not doing it just because you don't think you can win, and just go for it. And at the time, I didn't really have anything to lose, to be
mm-hmm.
honest. And I liked performing, you know, as we mentioned earlier.
Was that when you really learned that?
I mean, I liked, listen, I think you like reading an article about yourself that mm-hmm. says nice things.
Yeah.
I think that's yes. human nature.
I would agree.
I think you get hooked to that. So the camera was just the next part of that. It was blogs at that moment. And it was right. like e-gullet. And, uh-huh. you know, the right, look at this. And it was like yeah. all of these things like, oh, wow, I love when people talk about me when they say nice things and I'm going to prove them wrong if they don't.
Yeah.
And it's just that same mentality. It's just a fight. Right. It becomes a fight.
What is the... You know, it's weird. I don't know. I've known over the years, one of them happens to be one of my closest friends. I've known a number of people who won Top Chef. What's the sort of camaraderie, if any, for you with other people who've championed on that show?
Yeah. I mean, not even...
Because I feel
yeah.
like... Sorry to interrupt, but I feel like... You know, I'm a big tennis fan, right? And Mary Carrillo always says... jocks win Wimbledon, you know? And it's also been very rare of the U.S. Open that someone who doesn't prove to be an all-timer or a Hall of Famer wins the U.S. Open. Mm. I feel like, no disrespect to people who didn't get the crown,
right.
but I feel like real chefs win that show. I feel like really talented people do win that show.
Yeah. As someone who's won a season... Thank you.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? They don't go for the most flamboyant or the most showboaty or the I feel like real talent wins that show.
Yeah. And
at the end of the day,
I'm a fan of the franchise. I'm still connected, yep. obviously, in full disclosure, you know, in ways. But yeah, I mean, there's nothing fake about it. Let's put it that way.
Right.
And I would say for all of the television, even that I'm around, it is real. Like you yep. are watching people compete.
Yeah.
What I will say about Top Chef that people probably don't realize, though, is that it's deeper than just the one or two people that are standing at the end. That mm-hmm. the talent pool is literally 5, 6, 7 people each season who are real chefs.
You're talking about almost
half the cast.
That
every
you feel like really
year.
Have the chops, that it's like a fraction of a whatever that they could maybe win.
Or like maybe not win because again, there's a different thing that goes into competing.
Yeah.
But that are people that can and will potentially make an impact
in the industry.
In the industry mm-hmm. that are gonna get a James Beard. Like, you know, there's people who went out early in that show who have won James Beard Awards and
sure.
are running amazing restaurants and getting great reviews and changing the world.
Right.
Changing the country, you know. That being said, it's you know, you can usually see, you know, 3 or 4 people each season early on
sure.
who are like going to compete for it. Yeah.
So I know people who've done Top Chef Masters who have told me, you know, I did the show and my business went up 300%. Mm. Literally somebody once told me that. How
is this Rick Moonin? No, I'm just kidding. I'm just throwing out that.
No comment.
Nice. A friend of ours, I'm assuming.
Do we add clairvoyance yeah. to your abilities? do you... I'm still sort of reeling
nice,
from that.
Nice, that's good. Good shot right there.
How did it change your life?
You know, I mean, I think I say it changed a staircase to an escalator.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're already climbing up. It's yeah. not, you know, you're still going up it, you know, up that sort of hill, if you will. And
yeah.
it's going to expedite that process. So get
yep.
ready to move a little faster
mm-hmm.
And get ready for the opportunities that come your way. You know, I do wish, and something that I'd like to do, and I've become somewhat of an unofficial mentor to some contestants who have gone through the experience right now. The game doesn't really start though until it's over.
This is what I heard your podcast with Fabio.
Yeah, and
he said,
you know,
the
I mean,
game begins when the game. Why well, I wish I could do the game begins when the game ends.
Yeah, and then there was something yeah. about a goat and a wheel of cheese and
yeah.
salt, but yeah. Or no salt. And but it's true, like they're you don't really know what's going to happen after the show, you know, and especially for someone who wins and does well, it does change that staircase into a fast escalator.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got to figure out, you got to hold on to both sides or you got to know when to step off at the right time. And it can be challenging and difficult.
Mm-hmm. Did you go through a period of kind of having to calibrate your profession, just your life? I mean, you've got a lot of stuff going on at this point.
Yeah. I mean,
like
an awful
lot of stuff across an awful lot of mediums.
And I love it. I just absolutely love all the opportunities that I've been afforded. But, you know, I think here's one thing, and I got from The Last Magnificent. I think it's, you probably heard me talk about it in my podcast.
This is for people who don't know. The Last Magnificent is the documentary directed by Lydia Tenaglia, produced by Tony Bourdain, about the great Jeremiah Tower of Starz Restaurant, and before that, of Chez Panisse.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's Batali who in it says, you know, the mistake was you just can't stop working. You just can't stop working. So what happens on a show like a Top Chef or some yeah. sort of television show is if you get off the show and then you stop working, that's where people get derailed, you know? So like, I've always been a part of a restaurant. I've never not been a part of a restaurant.
When you say stop working, you mean specifically like go the celebrity route and don't be working in a kitchen, have a restaurant? Or do you mean go off the grid for a little bit?
I mean really being a part of a restaurant,
yeah,
specifically. Because what happens is then you fall into the trappings of perceived celebrity, and that could be a hot 30 days. It could be 60 days. Maybe it's 6 months if you're lucky, if you did really well. But you know, you have to work for that world. But the restaurant, that's going to be there for, you know, restaurants are going to be there for me all time, forever. I'm always going to have my hand at a restaurant. That's where I came from.
It's so fascinating to hear you say this, and I don't want to give away something that's in my book that I snuck you a copy of
today.
Yes,
thank you.
But I do have a book coming out about the chefs of the 70s and 80s, and this is something that I have thought about at great length, and I totally agree with you. I believe that if there's no restaurant, in some respects, you're not a chef anymore. You're not, at least the way the public perceives you. You don't have that, what publishing people call platform. You don't have that thing, that home base, a place to ply your craft. And the minute I think you stop having that, I think you start to recede, at least in other people's perception, from chefdom.
Yeah. Now listen,
unavoidably.
I'm many things.
Whether or not that's fair.
No, it's fair. Listen, I'm many things. I'm always going to be a chef. It's going to be one of those titles. And I do think that that's a mistake. Now, listen, if you have lined up all of those cards and you're going to just be whatever it is, an entrepreneur, a celebrity, and a television host or whatever, then that's great. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'd also want to make that clear.
Sure.
But I think that's what happens to the typical sort of talent that comes off of a television show, does well, realizes that they can travel the country a little bit and get paid maybe a little bit for it.
Yeah.
And then think that that's going to live forever just because of one television show that they went on or something like that. You got to work for the next television show. Right. You got to work for the next opportunity.
Yes.
Yeah.
So was this something that the success of that show, was that ever in doubt for you? In other words, were there so many opportunities available to you after winning the show? Was it a moment for you to kind of say, yeah, this really is important enough to me? Because what you do is really hard work, right?
Sure.
Being a cook, being a chef, that is hard work. That is physical work. You run marathons, but it doesn't get any easier. You're in your mid-40s now. It doesn't get easier.
That's true.
No, but I'm saying, was it a moment for you to go, you know what? I want to be here. I want to be doing this. Maybe I could be just doing other things, but no, I really want to be in a kitchen. This is who I am.
Yeah. Well, I this is where I'm going to have to come.
Or was that never in doubt?
No. Listen, in a kitchen also, let's be honest, I'm not on the line every night. I'm here in New York with you. My restaurants mostly are in California. You know, but being a part of a restaurant, being some part of a restaurant, that's important for me.
It is.
That being said, like, I love all of the other stuff as well. Mm-hmm. So with me, it's finding that time. It's turning up that speed, like I said on the podcast, two or three times the speed, so that I can actually have the ability to sort of perform in all of those different roles. Uh-huh. But that's what I loved about the opportunities that, like, a Top Chef gave me, is it gave me the opportunity to do many different things and to challenge myself, even something as simple as running a marathon. Like, if it wasn't for Top Chef, I wouldn't have run the marathon, because I wouldn't have thought that I could have.
For real?
Yeah. Like, when I won the show, I was like, oh, I can probably do a lot of other things that I didn't think I could do. Let's go run 26.2 miles. Let's do it for a charity. Let's try and open up another restaurant. Like, hey, maybe I can do a book. Maybe I could just not just compete on a show. Maybe I could judge one. Maybe I can not just judge one. I could host one. Maybe I could be in a movie. Like, all of these things that have happened to me.
Yes.
Is just from climbing that one step, one at a time, and just keep going. And also, reminding yourself that you might need those steps behind you if you're coming back down the stairs at some point. Hopefully that makes sense.
You've got several restaurants now.
Yes.
You live in San Diego now.
I do live in the Southern California area, yes.
What brought you out there?
This was a business opportunity. So again, I worked in Northern California at the French Laundry and sort of, just for lifestyle reasons, my wife and I, we were always going to sort of go west at some point.
Yeah.
Although I tried to convince her to come to New York at some point, and that was tough.
Where's she from?
She's from Tampa Bay.
Oh, okay.
And go Gators, you would like me to say.
I grew up in Florida.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
So California was going to happen. We were moving to Northern California. I met my business partner, Mike Rosen, who mm-hmm. I run a number of restaurants with right now. And, you know, he convinced us to come there and give it a shot. And it's become something that really, for me, has been the most successful I've been as a restaurateur and a chef, is developing those restaurants there in California.
Is there one particular, and maybe this is like asking you to pick like your favorite kid and you don't want to do it, but is there one particular restaurant that you have that is most you, or that's most sort of intrinsically Richard Blaze?
Yeah, I mean, again, there's not too many of them, so they're, you know, they're similar. There's many restaurants, but only a couple of concepts, if that makes sense.
Sure.
I mean, you know, Juniper and Ivy is sort of our more fine dining restaurant in San Diego. And I will say that going into that project, that there was a part of me that's like, this is sort of the last shot, you know, like, you
know, to do something like that.
To do something like that, that could, you know, become not just a restaurant that got great reviews or filled up for the first 3 months,
mm-hmm.
but something that could be sustainable, something that could be classic.
Yeah.
And again, the exact opposite of how I was thinking when I was doing 30-course menus. You know, what I wanted to create there was a restaurant that it's not successful unless it's here 10, 15, 20 years down the road.
Right.
And I think now, 4 years in, it's become that. It's becoming that.
Yeah.
So that's probably one that I have a lot. I mean, I'm proud of everything that I do.
Of course.
And I go hard with all of it.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, even this podcast. I'm going 9.5, 10.5.
Your podcast.
Yes. Yeah. What's that?
No, you mean your podcast. Right now.
Everything that I do. Wow. This is work.
You've done a couple of books.
I have done a couple of books. Well, they're tough, aren't they?
Did you enjoy that process? It seems to me like you would have a hard time with the grind of a book.
You know, it's weird. I was on Twitter the other day, and Chrissy Teigen, who knew she was going to pop up in this podcast, but she was writing about how she hates doing head notes for recipes.
Yeah, sure.
And it was weird because I love doing head notes for
you
recipes.
You do.
Matter of fact, it's the only thing that I really like doing.
That makes sense. Well, in a way that makes sense. Yeah.
Because it's like, wow, this is where so much personality comes out to me, is in the head notes, not the chapter opens.
Yes.
Not the recipes.
Yeah.
And I'm, even though people think I'm a very much of a technician and a gram scale sort of guy and a tweezer sort of chef, I'm much more a baby's handful of salt sort of chef.
Right.
Especially when I'm doing, you know, food that's supposed to be
which makes
for
writing
a home
recipes a drag.
Which, makes it tough for publishers. It makes it tough for someone who wants to say, no, I just want this to be, you know, a little bit of sage chopped up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how I like to talk about food.
Yeah.
It doesn't really work great in books. So I don't think I've figured it out yet. I have two books. They both mean a lot to me. The first book was nominated for a James Beard Award, which, you know, is what
people... That was Try This at Home?
Yes, which is what people say when they don't win things. it was nominated. And the second one, which is, you know, on the shelves right now, So Good, I think is a better cookbook, which is really weird.
How do you mean that? Why?
The first book, Try This at Home, was really like the last 10 years of Richard Blaze's life. Here's a couple recipes, and they're reflective of those 10 years.
Yeah. Great cover, though.
Thanks. Thank you.
I love
that
cover.
It was a fun cover and totally impromptu. Like, we just shot it one day at lunch and we're like, let's try and do that. And So Good is a better cookbook. I mean, like, you can open it up and cook through a recipe and put a delicious meal on the table for your family.
Yeah.
Because that was more of the goal of the book, which is going to sound really horrible as a chef, but, you know, and you've probably worked with so many chefs, you know, sometimes when I was younger, you're writing recipes to sort of impress your colleagues sometimes.
Yeah.
You're not thinking about Mary Smith in Kansas.
Yeah.
Who's going to actually cook that food and wine recipe.
Yeah.
And like, you have a responsibility to Mary Smith.
Yeah.
And like, I've learned that the hard way by getting lots of emails from Mary Smith over
Well,
the years.
I've seen I mean, I'm only a few years older than you, but when I started doing, the first book I ever did was the Gotham Bar and Grill cookbook.
Amazing.
And at that time, the chef cookbook thing was, people really wanted the food the way it was done in the restaurant. Like, that book, you're basically replicating the food Alfred was doing at the Gotham in the 80s and 90s. I mean, it is that... But, you know, you could...
One of my first, serious date nights was at Gotham.
At the Gotham?
Yeah.
But you
and
could,
that book's meant a lot to me, so thank you for that.
Thank you very much. I mean, my career started with that book. And amazingly, I was a... We'll talk about this when Alfred comes on the show next year. But I was actually a replacement writer on that book. But what I was going to say is, you know, three or four different types of herbs, the number of recipes in that book that have chervil, you know, ring molds. you know?
Remolt. Here's my favorite.
But that was,
here's
that
my
was
favorite
a time
thing.
When people actually wanted that, and now that is a fight with your publisher to do that kind of stuff.
Here's my favorite.
As probably it should be.
My favorite thing in all of those books from that era, and I'm not sure if it's the Gotham book, so I apologize.
That's
if it's
okay.
Not, is this headline, or this sort of recipe note. Add chicken stock and reduce by half. That should be the name of our next podcast episode. Add chicken stock and reduce by half. Every single sauce and recipe had right. that in it back in those days, whether it was White Heat or the
everything.
Gotham book, everything.
Yeah. So your podcast, Starving for Attention.
Yes.
Why, okay, with everything you have going on, why the podcast?
Which I
love, by the way.
Thank you so much. And we're having a lot of fun doing it. I actually enjoy it.
Yeah.
I get, again, to do it with my wife, Jasmine,
yes.
Who's there every once in a while on the pod. And I'm a fan of podcasts. So usually it was like recaps of Game of Thrones and Westworld. And
yeah.
I'm a big sports guy listening to whatever. And you know, Freakonomics and all these sort of like real traditional, like old school, really
yeah.
well-regarded podcasts. Malcolm Gladwell, all of that stuff. And I was like, there wasn't, you know, until you came along. Right? Until I came, there's not a lot of food podcasts. So
no.
It's kind of an open space. And, you know, I felt like it would be fun to sort of try and capture some of those moments. Like we call our studio the walk-in.
Yes.
And I think, I meant going back to the last Magnificent movie, that one of my favorite shots of that whole movie is when Jeremiah is in the walk-in and a cook comes in and he's like, get out of here, bad day.
Bad morning.
There's a meeting.
Yeah,
bad morning.
And they close the
because,
door.
Because like that's where chefs have meetings, in walk-ins. And, you know, yeah. we wanted to sort of capture that. Like, let's chop it up and get real about our industry and not necessarily just talk
well,
about
it. Well, the funny thing is when you say there aren't that many food podcasts, you know, I, for years now, I don't know when I first hit on this realization, might have been when I did this book, Knives at Dawn, about the Bocuse d'Or competition. Mm-hmm. But I had this epiphany, which is, you know, for all the cookbooks I had done, the reason people hired me, because I didn't come from a food background, I came as someone who was trying to be a writer, people hired me for like the biographical part at the front of the book
right.
for writing that. They hired me for the head notes. They hired me for the writing,
right?
And at some point I realized, you know what? I'm not a food writer really, I'm a chef writer. And I feel like, it's why I was sort of surprised that I was able to get you on the show, because I do feel like, in a lot of respects, you're, I don't necessarily think of your podcast as a food, I think of it as like a chef in a restaurant.
Yeah,
podcast.
No, you're 100%.
Well, as opposed to, you're not really, I mean, it comes up and maybe there's an episode or two I'm not thinking of, but you're not really talking about cooking, recipes. You're talking about the, even when you have someone like Besha on,
right?
You're talking about the industry.
Yeah.
Right?
And with intent.
And that, I do think, is unusual.
Yeah, with intent, because, you know, I'm not that expert, you know, and, you know, we always joke, I think you probably, you know, there's the SNL skit, you know, the
NPR
public
show.
Radio
yeah,
NPR show.
Yeah, sure.
Talking about gourds and
yes.
what did you bake last
yeah.
night.
And just like, very hushed
there,
tone.
Yeah, there's,
yeah.
There's a challenge with audio, especially with food,
yeah.
Especially if you're starting to talk about cooking or recipes, which I think you do need to see sometimes. You do need to smell, you know. So we wanted to just stay away from the potential of really digging into recipes.
Yeah.
And you know, there are parts about like our world that also bother me to no end. And one of them is that just like hashing it out about a recipe or sitting down with someone who doesn't really know you and they want to talk about onions and garlic. And
yeah.
I want to talk about, you know, Porzingis and the Knicks or tennis or whatever
yeah.
that is.
It's funny though, cause I've always felt a little, I mean, I love food. I've always loved since I was a kid going to a restaurant. I remember the first time, it's embarrassing where it was, but the first time I ever walked into a restaurant in New York and they knew me.
Right.
You know, because I'd been in, put my name on the list so many
sure.
times. That happened to me in college and I thought, oh, man, that's a good, I like that feeling. You know, I've always loved food.
Yes.
I do. I love great food. I love the experience of dining. When I have time to be leisurely about it, which is rare now with two kids and, you know, very busy career, I do love to cook. But I would never in my life have described myself as a foodie. I don't make food pilgrimages. Like, I have nothing against, most of my friends do these kind, you know, I've never been to Arthur Avenue in the Bronx
right.
to get the Italian food. It's not, most of my friends do that and are that person, but I am fascinated by people who do what you do. And I just
you like the story with inside the story.
The story, the profession. I find other people's passions and creativity to be interesting.
How I'm going to flip the script on
That's
you
fine.
Here a little bit. I mean, your industry now is so saturated.
Writing,
right?
Totally.
Food writing, like people now that are specifically writing only about food,
yeah.
and that are proclaimed foodies. Like, where's that going to go? Like, is the food critic dead? That's another. Like,
I don't think the critic is dead. No,
maybe
the
not
restaurant
in New York.
Critic.
The restaurant critic.
I don't think so.
No, it's not what it was
because it's so diluted,
right?
Because by the number of outlets, I think, and by also the civilian journal, the civilian reviewers of Yelp and
civilians. I like that.
No, but those people, sure. I think it's been very diluted. I think the power of I've actually made a point of not plugging it this season, but this will be my last episode of the season. So get ready, everyone, because I'm going to be plugging like crazy in the new year. But this book I just finished that's coming out, the way people talk about the New York Times. I mean, you want to talk about the Death Star in those days?
Sure.
A bad review from the New York Times in the 1970s, 1980s could put your lights out.
Yeah.
That, I don't think, is really the case anymore.
Right. And I think that was like even watching The Last Magnificent was a part that if you're not from New York, it's hard to understand like why a chef would lose his job over a star in the New York Times.
Oh, my God.
I get it because I've lived through it and it's something we're aware of.
But
I guess because I don't live in New York.
Yeah,
that is something that's changing around the country for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about my profession, writing about all this, is when I started doing what I do, I started by accident.
Yes,
Alfred Portale was my client. I used to be a publicist. I was trying to write screenplays. My day job was being a publicist. I went into it thinking. This is before Ken Cosgrove on Mad Men or Christopher on The Sopranos. As an out-of-work writer, I was like, what do you do? You write ad copy or you be a PR guy. I literally just didn't know what else to do. I got the job through the New York Times, and I happened to end up at the time, the top restaurant PR firm in New York. And all of a sudden, I was spending time with all these chefs. I had no intention ever of writing about these people. But when I started working with Alfred and that book came out and took off, there was really no one who specialized in that. I mean, now everyone's looking to collaborate. We're all friends, and I mean that legitimately. I feel a lot of camaraderie with people who do what I do. But at the time, that was a huge opportunity for me. And, most people who collaborated were food writers who did it as a one-off or maybe they did it once in a while. There was very little effort made to sound like the chef on the page.
Right.
All these chef books kind of, it was this sort of journalese. No, it was just this, they communicated the information, but there was no effort really made for the book to be a reading experience,
Unfortunately, yes. I love tomatoes in the summer.
Right.
We all love tomatoes in the summer.
Right. But when I came into it and tried to really write, that stood out, and that gave me my career.
Are you upset?
But it is very different.
Are you upset with me that I now have sort of put a toe in the sort of media world?
No, why? What
and
do you
I don't mean personally.
That you're
with
doing
me.
A podcast?
No, because it's interesting that I'm doing a podcast.
This is only
or
like
whatever,
my 13th episode.
Whether I'm blogging or
get out
like,
of my territory.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it's like no. I'm just there was a moment where the celebrity chef bothered me as a chef.
Yeah.
And now I'm sort of the celebrity chef, and I look back at that times, and I'm like, I was so upset about the celebrity chef opening up a restaurant.
Now we just met.
Yes, this
is
true.
But even from afar, it's clear that. You're still working really hard. You said it in this interview. You've got restaurants. It's always going to be a part of your life.
Yes.
You are very thoughtful about what you do. I mean, I'm not trying to kiss your ass, but you're not phoning it in. It's funny. I listened to the interview you did with Fabio where he said he learned the lesson finally to do 5 things really well instead of doing 10 things half-assed.
Right? Yes.
And it seems to me like you said even about this interview, like you try to go all in on whatever you're doing.
Yes.
So to answer your question, which I don't think was really meant as a question, no. What bothers me is when people do anything, including restaurants, in a half-assed way.
Right.
Because you are taking people's money and or their time.
Sure,
and
sure.
Ooh, that,
time is one of my favorite
that
topics.
That really pisses me off.
Yeah.
That when people, I mean, to me, people who don't treat the restaurant experience with some degree of seriousness, I feel like that is such a violation of sort of the social contract of hospitality.
Well said.
Said.
Yeah, no, 100%.
That's offensive to me.
I agree with you. Yeah. I do think the other side of that is that Sometimes though, the guest takes the experience with too much, like there's too much.
How do you mean that? You
pretense
mean
that goes into like
pretense?
Yeah, as
I think we're gonna say like almost like. But I would probably add to that, you know, abusiveness.
It goes back to the foodie.
They take the idea of the customer's always right too far.
Yeah, or it goes back to the I'm a foodie, and again, there are certain restaurants. If you're paying a price of a 3 Michelin star restaurant, there should be no mistakes.
Right.
But there are mistakes in restaurants.
Yes.
You know,
unavoidably.
And I think there is that, like you're saying, this sort of contract that the guest and the restaurateur has to understand that, like, hey, you know, the point is if someone makes a mistake in this relationship, we're going to fix it right here on the spot.
Yeah.
And that's not always the case.
No. And the recovery
on both sides.
And the recovery can be the most beautiful thing about an experience.
I mean, that's what hospitality is all about.
Yes.
I mean, with my staff, I'm always saying that. Like, it's really not about just putting out great food. The true hospitality moment happens when something goes wrong.
Yeah.
And it's being aware of when that sort of something might be wrong moment is it.
I try not to, I try to be the, you know, I've said more than once in restaurants where people don't know me, you know, I'm glad it was me. It had to be somebody, I'm glad it was me.
Yes.
You know, this is your lucky night. I understand. I know what you guys are up against.
There you go.
You know, I've been in restaurants where it's clear to me that one of the servers was a no-show or called in sick and that somebody's working double the tables they should.
Right.
You know, and I'll ask them.
Yes.
You know what I mean.
Yeah, but that's not okay at the airport where you know it's going to be busy every single day. Not to get under one of my pet peeves, but
yes. So, but you know, the rare time that I've kind of dropped a dime on somebody, I remember once being on vacation and this guy came out and kind of threw the kitchen under the bus.
Oh,
you know?
Ooh.
And the next day I went and saw the F&B manager of the resort we were staying in. And I said, I just have to tell you, I don't even think I told him what I did or, you know, quote unquote, who I was or whatever. But I just said, this was so offensive to me.
Right.
I think I said a lot of my friends are cooks, or you know, something like that.
Sure.
And I was really offended that this guy threw the kitchen under the bus. That's not what you guys are all part of the same team.
That's true. You know? That's so true.
So anyway.
You're a good man.
Well, thank you, Richard. Yes. Right back at you.
Nice.
So can I ask before we sign off, what's on your bucket list still at this point?
Wow. Bucket list is, you know, making a big impact and sort of trying to connect all the dots to do something that eventually leads to, you know, what I'd like to be a legacy sort of moment, although the goalposts, or, you know, the goal line's always changing for me.
Yeah.
I've been obsessed with entrepreneurship and tech and sort of scale and trying to figure out, okay, well, you know, how can I do this one thing that I'm good at, whether it's a podcast or a television show or a restaurant or a book, you know, how do you do it for millions of people? That's sort of where my head's at right now. So nothing to like report on, except that I think 2018 and moving forward, I'm obsessed with the future.
Yeah.
And, you know, not just...
It's a great feeling, isn't it?
It is a great feeling because, like, I know it's there, you know, which is a real, like, you know, even, like, if you're cooking in a kitchen and you know, like, you're really close to making something that's beautiful, or, like, you're really close to creating that signature dish.
Yeah.
I know it's close. I think it's going to be something that, you know, probably combines all of these skills that I've built.
Yeah.
But something that sort of presents itself in a new way.
Awesome. Thanks for being my last guest of the season.
I can't. That's amazing. So this is like, you know, like we're partying at the end here. This is the end of the
year. We're gonna have a wrap party.
Yes, I mean, I can't wait. I love wrap parties.
Great meeting you.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
And that's our show. A huge thank you to Richard Blaze. Richard, I had such a great time talking to you and trying to keep up with you, which was a lot of fun and no small challenge. I hope we'll get to do it again on your show when my book comes out, and I hope you don't mind me putting you on the spot at the end of this show, but it would just be a real kick to come on and talk to you about my book in the spring. For everyone else, I think I plugged everything I have to plug. I think I thanked everyone I needed to thank at the top of the show. So I'll just say that it's obviously a trying time in my industry. It's a trying time in the country and the world. I hope the next few weeks are kind to all of you and to all of us, and that we're all back here, no worse for wear, in January when season 2 picks up. I really appreciate everyone being a part of season 1. I've had just one of the great times of my career doing it, and I look forward to and hope to be able to do it for many seasons and many years to come. And I'll look forward to seeing all of you back here in January when we pick up with season 2 of Andrew Talks to Chefs. Thanks so much for listening, and all the best in the new year.